have a jury. And we train them to push you. I remember years and years ago getting instructions from Michael Davis about how to conduct yourself in front of a microphone. I think we were doing a reading in Fred Zeppelin's, and he was saying, he would notice that all these English language poets, he said, make out as if they've never seen a microphone before, because they're real poets, you know. So they all talk to the side of it, and you can't really hear what they're saying. Because they write in English, and they expect to be asked back lots of times. But he said, because you write in Irish, you might never get another chance. So you just make sure you get in nice and short. I was just thinking there, the last time I think I read here was probably 1980 or 1981, and I developed a very bad habit on that occasion, because I had 5 minutes, everybody had 5 minutes, and I had only 2 poems, so I had to do a lot of padding out in between the poems, and it's a bad habit I never properly addressed. I do an awful lot of talking between the poems, but I'm going to try and sort it out tonight, because here I'm coming back to meet myself as I was at the age of whatever it was back then. I've just finished putting together a selected poems, Roald Dahl's Askeleinn, and I thought I'd start by reading some older poems, and I thought I'd read a number of poems that deal, I suppose, with the lifestyle choices that poor old Michael Noonan's family have had to make. It's just amazing the way that emigration has come back, and the same old insistence that it's not economically motivated, and it's because the people who leave really are selfish and greedy and want better cars and all the rest of it. And I wrote a number of poems when I left Ireland in the mid-1980s, the last time that people were leaving the country in great numbers, and this is one of those poems. It's called Corcach. Corcach, of course, being Cork. I'm taking its name from the marsh, and the marsh is where my father's family come from. But there's also this idea of a marshiness and bogginess and softness at the centre of the poem. I remember all the time I wrote it, there'd been an interview on Irish television with the great Australian artist Sidney Nolan, and he was talking to David Hanley, and he was saying that he didn't know much about Ireland growing up, but he knew 2 things were essential before he came here. One was that Clare people were hard and Cork people were soft. And I had that partly in the back of my mind when I wrote this poem, as like Corcach. What I do all evening is I'll read parts of the poem in Irish and then go into English and then back to the Irish again. Ishe fur fluch ar French's key is made a trial ar ish on Malia. And heart in a shasav, got lule she goes on, le board sehig builte le kala. Shanavin strakehe, on monarchan dunte, a shkriebe fallen a cave, sonite in her honig, na fronke gedir. E gaher na guan, is an owing a titum on spare, be fine at har hala, skorta da huile, trasna na sride, o hachna sochride. Be sklokvi be an vardish, a dachte, ek famin vrusker, a vruch denis, a trofwi hir. Is madri baite a dúirt chun siúil i málaí gúil ar farig amach i dro an fasáiste hir. It was cold and wet on French's quay the day I left, the car tight to the curb at the side of a ship tied up at the pier. Worn out tyres from the shut down factory scraped the quay wall where the rats had come ashore. In our submarine town the river rained down from above. A lifebelt worked its way free from a mooring post across the street from Ford's funeral home. Corporation gutters were choked with wrack brought in by the tide, as drowned dogs stowed away in coal bags were washed out to sea through passage west. The back of the car was warm as a kitchen, watertight as a fish's arse, until a single swollen drop fell on the windscreen, trickled through a crack in the reinforced glass, and along the bridge of our captain's nose, where he sat unmoved in the front seat. When the river banks broke behind my father's eyes, tin buckets couldn't bail me out, as tears gushed through the eye of a needle, and Jesus wept over my submerged head. Church spires and railway lines crumpled, millstones and hearts like stone were broken, walls and flagstones buckled, as the earth moved and the asthmatic bog filled my lungs again. I couldn't wait to get away from the soft, soft earth that had made me. before the last tear was squeezed from the stone in my heart, before love wrapped itself round my neck, dragging me, drowning, home. Adilum gudraging and sreiro vugd ar dihme, saravash fi and dior yernach as and loch in lar, saragach and gra, a gha live timpum of an eel, tal harin cheese, good poin and fweel, a walia. So. That was before leaving, and this is a short while after. There's a poem called Phone Call, and because almost nobody ever writes to you when you go away, you discover that the Irish are not the greatest letter writers in the world, and they're not the best at phone either, that's the other thing. But usually when people phone, it's the wrong time. Nobody ever bothers to check the time, and there might be a time difference. So in Australia, there's a big time difference. So if somebody is ringing you from here in the middle of the day, it's likely to be 3 or 4 in the morning over there. And you jump out of bed thinking someone must be dead at home or something. A very cheerful voice on the other end of the phone says, "Geez, you must go to bed very early over there." This is a poem about being in two places at the same time, I suppose, and it really isn't until you get the voice moment, because you're a bit kind of disoriented in the middle of the night, you're not quite sure where you are, because the voice on the other phone is so familiar to you, and it's the part of you that you push to the back of your mind, and then suddenly the two worlds collide. And it's the middle of the night in Australia, where it's the middle of the day in Ireland. If it's summer in Australia, it's winter here, and everything is inside out and back to front, as it should be, of course. So this poem is called Gleach Gohain. Sar dosnig an gohain a buala tranon a mianer, di creenly moin ar chul an tí, a luba fe uolach solish, sem gria na sharafen, le gieg a quit. I paroid in aida aspeit a prechai le scuin imionian a deish le na hanamain ugrogach ho craifach corahonach le buachali al tora. I maigin a tura in rian vorub nu garanig de ghor shultach o chahar foblach de lar portig ma reporter ar board is Oliver tronchushach ar shul I maskandre ulna scuini fada I dihe oil koshawan. Is gwe stolta, mar ddoch gwe thra rower on mal has, a rolail tre gieg an a groan, na rhaid an chapul gwi. Hwy ddoch aint lawn da gwili ilan nes glwn, a dornal iost le sgail in a machuina. Fogl tiofod a rwsg a trin llawn, is ddoch o asuul a ras iocht, mar ddoch roller coaster llawn sgwilta, sa charnival i mon a tairna. E lawr a verifin ne gahar Melbourne, di frasgol pibe e clagernach sa tomra, Of you reel in a bashdi, a scantry gear, a gashenem, a mare a mara, a urlish yorsa, a gahar an ish orga. Until the phone started ringing, it was just a January afternoon. Behind the house, lemon trees stooped under the weight of light, the sun stretched with cat's paws. A parrot in bishop's vestments preached to a flock of the lesser birds who listened to his hacking homily. As piously shifty as altar boys. The unforgiving sun had squeezed my thoughts dry until I heard your voice from the other world, from a city republic in the middle of a bog, where tables were heavy with porter, and woolly jumpers and long skirts deep in metaphysical debate in pubs along the quays, where a blustering wind like a bloated banker from the South Mall gusted through beggar trees on the Grand Parade. Your talk was all elbows and knees, boxing shadows in my head. Tough words rampaging through my brain as your unrepentant voice cut loose like a runaway roller coaster at the carnival in Crosshaven. In the swelter of Melbourne, pipe music drenched the room as reels of rain and winter tunes were played by quick fingers on ancient instruments in the city of the Goldie Fish. Wow. I've written a poem which I hadn't thought I'd read, but I think it might be good to read after that. A poem called Didgeridoo, and it's kind of self-explanatory, but perhaps at the same time, so I have to say that one of the peculiar things about being Irish in Australia is that the history of the relationship between Irish people and Aboriginal people in Australia is a particularly ambiguous one. That on the one hand, it seems that more Irish men were likely to marry Aboriginal women than almost any other ethnic group amongst the white settlers, and on the other hand, Irish people participated cheerfully in the attempted genocide of Aboriginal people. So the poem kind of tries to find its way in amongst those two different things, I suppose. The other thing was, I used to listen to an Aboriginal man playing the didgeridoo at a big market in the middle of Melbourne, and there was a woman with him who used to try and explain the music, and like a didgeridoo can only play two notes. So if you, as Seamus Heaney likes to say, if you dwell within that acoustic, it's a whole music, but if your ear isn't tuned to it, it's just two notes, and there's a limit to what it can communicate. So she used to explain the birds' sounds you should be able to hear, and then there were certain pieces which were narrative pieces telling stories with two notes, and I could never hear anything. And that's again what the poem is about, I suppose, the idea that one of the things that makes every culture and every language unique is that there's a point beyond which you can't enter it. And I think one of the things you deal with if you're an Irish language poet is that even if you learn the Irish language, you discover there's a point in our history and our literature and our imagination beyond which we can't go, that we are actually at the wrong end of a broken tradition and language. So there's that at the back of it as well, I suppose. Didgeridoo, anyway. Ní valigam cioolseo na ar ní a níos as íochtar cishán da bhuilig le brotha seanama na mruch an teoir trasach. Ní chuirise da chos ganarcach a step brinc ar leach gan bhaeachas da daigin a chiartasach le sprawn tais na gasfort cahach. Má hasan tú gan chor ar fa second of aing no míle blian. Chuirise alta liré na nyadú i masc na gúach a da chlean old cawm. Paroidi gorama, glasa, daruga, do huili lushkira, is kugabur and nigoiduch, a phonoid, fed a chose gala. Big trevena orsa an air, a clettern of timpalurk, a lorthat de male raw, na tigam de chri, golgailach, bon. Ma hasantu, chahia blia negeshtucht, clusher kyol star a chine, a shilla, as una her polta, gear hoba ean, a knag a playas, a snap a myung chnav. Agus dóir na gala ar sin seo cneasta a buala a chreacan a chalún mar bheith bórán ná mohíon faic. This music is not played to lure a snake from the woven basket of your distended belly with a heat wave of torrid notes and swooning melodies. It won't set your rebel foot tapping on stone to taunt your straight-jacketed intellect with squalls of hornpipes and twisting slides. If you stand and listen for a second or a thousand years, lyrebirds will nest in the devious loops of your branching hair. Blue, green and red parrots will perch on your scalded shoulders, and a sarcastic kookaburra make fun of your scorched white feet. You'll hear parakeets and lorikeets flutter round your head, ancient tribes of the air speaking a language your wild colonial heart cannot comprehend. If you can stand for a minute or 200 years, you'll hear the sounds of his people bleed from a punctured lung. Sharp beaks, pecking skulls, snapping small bones. By the bright fists of our gentle ancestors, beat the skin of the earth like a boron that feels nothing.
Something a bit more cheerful, so... Not much, no, but this is a poem called "On Cruthaor, the Creator," and it was one of the things that happens when you're a long time away from home is you become much more conscious of how much you depend on memory and how unreliable it is, and you start to put, because there's nobody you can check it with anymore, and it's a very gapped thing, so you start to put together, in this case in a poem, just to hold on to certain things that you think you remember, and that can be almost as important. In fact, it's funny, one of the times I read that poem on the didgeridoo, I was doing a tour of Tasmania with a prose writer from Melbourne, and he thought it was the funniest thing he ever heard, because didgeridoo player I used to go to listen was a fraud. He was a fake. He wasn't Aboriginal at all, and he couldn't really play the didgeridoo. So it's almost as important, maybe when you're thinking of memory and that, like whether it's true or not, isn't it quite the point? The other thing I should say, because of course poetic license is very important in all these things, my mother was present once ever when I read this poem and didn't speak to me for quite some time, so I have to explain that there's a reference to chipped plates in this poem, and there were never any chipped plates. It wouldn't have worked, though. Yeah. On Crowley Hoard, I'll just do the first couple of verses in Irish and then the translation back to Irish. Sarah Rairig and Navaid in Anis, a Shibol Doracha Heath, their Vohr and a Moerma, the Gut Smolig, the Fogarton lay, the Knaga, their Scraggle Chapin, Budiel Banya, their Lick and Dorishamo. Sarah Hushigan Teak, as a Huan Ray of Dreha, the Endowan Hui Fenike, Dowan Diabuinta, nor Lower in a Crinne. A Yale Gorraig, do the Ross Queen a law. Before the morning rose from a dark shed below on the model farm road, a thrush's beak announced the day, pecking the tinfoil top of a milk bottle out on the doorstep. Before the house woke from its prenatal sleep, she had the world to herself, a well-mannered world that didn't answer back, giving in quietly to the gentle authority of her hands. When she unmuzzled the spout, cold water nuzzled her hands, licking her dry fingers. When she turned off the tap, the runny nose continued to drip in the sink, and a gimpy kettle limped on the stove. Nothing was perfect in this bockety house. Chipped dishes welcomed her, plates, mugs and egg cups jostling each other, until she filled their hungry mouths with cornflakes crisp as frosted grass. Handsome eggs with moles on their cheeks, and tea so strong a mouse might scamper across its steaming surface on tiny legs of faith without drowning. Up the stairs in limbo, land of pillows and blankets, rags of sleep bandaged his brain like cotton wool in an aching ear. He heard the muffled sound of the small shovel scraping stone as she cleared the ashes of the day gone out, and set another day kindling in the cold grate. He heard gusts of static pitched from one end of the Atlantic to the other, churning the airwaves between Reykjavik and Athlone, until she found the right frequency that put Cork at the centre of the world, talking to her quietly in the kitchen, 6 feet under his dream. As morning followed morning, forever and ever it seemed, he heard his world created out of nothing, as it was in the beginning, is now, and shall be for a time to come in the mind of the Creator, until the clock wakes her from her eternal dream. Maidin in ege chéile mar sin go bráach, chúla sé sail ach rahú as nán ní, mar vír dúsh, mar a tánish, mar a bheith go fóil an aigin an chrói hóra, nú go músgóig an plug dí, as a bringloid hír í. There's a poem called Coachellig in Sul. I'll just read this one in a translation. Conspiracy of Eyes. Her picture is in the morning paper, the girl who's been missing for a week. She looks at me like she must have looked at the one who took the photograph, a close friend or boyfriend, I'd say, from the hint of mischief in her eyes. She looks at me with complete misplaced confidence. And still, I feel a jitter hanging over her smile, worrying the corners of her mouth, as if she'd got some inkling before the conspiring of eyes from which she was born. She wasn't long for this world. She looks nothing at all like any of my daughters. But God has gone missing for the past week, and I can't look too closely at the drowsy young ones at their breakfast beside me, the living picture of the one I love best. I put the morning paper between me and the complete misplaced confidence that stares me out from their dark eyes unafraid. Some more recent poems, not necessarily very new, but there's a poem called Idir Ghaleen, and it's a poem about a child, but kind of interested for a long time in poems about things that are final, that there's no going back from, that you measure time after that from that moment where something traumatic usually happened, and it's usually somebody's death, and it's a week after or a month after or whatever it is, but it can also be the chaos introduced to the world by the birth of a child, and from that also there's no going back. So this is a poem called Idir Ghaleen, set in Melbourne, so that's where the reference to a particular street name. Idir Ghaleen. Tá am na gúrtóirí thart is táim im chasamh ag stadan bhos trasna na sráide ó óspidéal riaga na man. Dréim docht agam ar láha na lenaí. Tá áhas a chur di in áir de cín mar is gná agus áras a drathair a pléasca le hisce. An áin na dróireach a thugis dom ar bowl, ní lis agam mó chalab an domhain cén in óg a willantú i de chasamh le de bhorla beagdóchais is caca. Ní adrim ach lehid praid gratin ceru or lár agus pasáis de gair an te siptach ach tá sé ró dhéan a chana le dó siir thar na puíl dhuga in rompa an ama. Má gá láid go chur timpal ort is fiachan thar do húling amach ar an gléatúr boch de stad an bus a bhul íb an tonis ar a bhéal agus gleim scuilte ag na leanaí ar a láha. Tá in é chur di gan stop i nuuf a pléasca le hisce a mairach in a colla chayach ar ocht a maher. In the meantime, visiting time is over and I'm standing at the bus stop across the street from the Royal Women's Hospital holding the children's hands as tight as I can. Happiness is prattling away non-stop as usual while not so sure her brother is bursting for a piss. After all the directions you gave me a short while ago, I can't for the life of me remember which window you're at with your little bundle of hope and shit. There's nothing between us, only the width of Grattan Street, four floors and a short antiseptic corridor, but it's already too late to cross over the small potholes in the surface of time, to put my arms around you and look out over your shoulder at the poor fool standing there at the bus stop, smiling happily with his children holding his hands. Yesterday, talking non-stop. Today, bursting for a piss. Tomorrow, fast asleep at her mother's breast. Thank you very much. Just about a few more here, maybe. This poem is called Marmalade, and it's a love poem, so I'll just read it in a translation. I take the lid off the jar of marmalade, and morning swells with the bitter, no, sweet taste of Algiers, Morocco, Seville, where fragrant bonds hang from the branches of trees. When they explode on the white earth, I like the ones with blood in them best. The air is scorched for miles around. I taste the noise of revolution and street markets in places I have never been, but that my nose still remembers their bitter, no, sweet smell. When I return to the kitchen, worn out from my journey over the borders of the sensible, get real, you say, frowning. I bought those oranges in the butcher's yesterday, and it was I who made the marmalade, bitter sweet, the way you like it. Exactly, I say, as the fragrant bonds of your body burn the air all around me. The riot has already started in the street market of my heart, just there beside the stall of oranges. And just two more stories. There's a poem called Galway Kinnell in Galway, and Galway Kinnell is one of my favourite poets. Great American poet, a very famous poem called St. Francis and the Sow, and I've lifted some of the lines from that into this poem, and they stick out fairly obviously in Irish, but not quite in English, and if I've grafted it properly at all, you shouldn't be able to see the join, alright, but if you find yourself saying to yourself quietly, ah, that's lovely, he wrote that bit, right? I was at a thing in Mayo a few years ago up in Castlebar in the library there, and Mayo County Council had a competition for Mayo's favourite poem, and it was a complete fix because Raftery was 1, 2, 3, and 4, the poet Raftery from Mayo, but Galway Kinnell was a very creditable 5th. St. Francis and the Soul, great poem. Galway Kinnell and Galway. Here we go. We stood in the queue as if we were at a removal, clasping his poems like prayer books to our chests. When he stood up from his chair, it was hard to tell whether it was one of the dead man's brothers shaking your hand, or the corpse himself that had risen from the coffin to shake the hand of a friend he no longer recognised. When he signed the books with an old fountain pen, it was as if St. Francis had taken over from his cantankerous companion at the gates of heaven, that everyone would be let in from here on in by the man who taught the sow its awkward beauty, so that it blossomed in its own nature. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing, though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. When his eyes caught ours, we recognised the loneliness and the gentle hurt. I know, his eyes said, a good teacher in the wrong class, there's no need to teach any of you anything about loneliness, though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. He warned us not to close the books until the ink had dried on the page. When I looked around me, books were shaking themselves dry in the foyer of the theatre, like seagulls after a shower, or young goths shaking the handkerchiefs of their hands to harden the varnish on their blackened nails. And oh Galway, my old pal, if only our tears would dry as quick and the wounded heart harden. I'm just going to do one more poem, and I've only just finished this, so I hope it's okay. I think it's about as far as I'm going to get it, but you never know. I've translated as Brian O'Driscoll meets Thomas Transtormer, so I reckon if it's any good at all, I'm kind of in with a good chance there, aren't I? It's, there's more people likely to know who Brian O'Driscoll is, perhaps, than Thomas Transtormer. But you never know. I've been reading Transtormer, and there were a few lines from poems of his that I just wanted to kind of work them on the page. There's a lovely article written in the first John McGahern yearbook by Joseph O'Connor, where he says that when he started writing, first of all, he said he wanted to know what it was like to write a masterpiece. So he copied a story by John McGahern to just feel what it would be like to shape the world. So there was a bit of that. I was kind of thinking, like, if you had that image, what would it be like? And I was thinking, of course, the fact that he had a stroke, which means this most extraordinary articulate poet can't speak. And then Brian O'Driscoll came out of nowhere. And I remember that his father had said in an interview some years ago that the reason O'Driscoll slips through gaps that aren't there in the field is because he's half blind. He has very defective eyesight, so he doesn't realise that the gaps aren't there at all. So I thought there was a kind of a moral there somewhere. So you'll see what happens. Okay, here we go. Thomas Transtormer gets Brian O'Driscoll, O'Driscoll, I suppose it should be from Ballingary. The first bit of an Irish anyone see. The Dalavaim at an angle, a gaira gumi huinach, la smut, an aglish yeta. Mar winfi to, a speagui, a dortan fila, gurbunito, a hanga, a hien an sail, ni salera na aenya, a vocul na fetal a shara, a drachen shashis, a lower balm, a rebefene. Er chuldach bog un lower, ta baechas ni grenya don solus, ho gle, le suil gorum un ri, a will a hail katige, a gimachtre varni na filon, fork imerhe on oir. A churn of spare as an arrogant a shasov, a bull a bass as a lurig le hahas, a vaurian er fa alle, clog an aurish, a tal bull a goni, a grieg a chenye. The wooden statue of the angel was smiling uneasily outside the padlocked church, as if someone had taken his glasses, said the poet, robbed of his voice, who sees the world more clearly than anyone in words he can't speak, as he writes them down in the white book of himself. On the soft cover of the book, the son's gratitude to the lice is clear as the blue eyes of the king who spent his life slipping through gaps that weren't there on the battle pitch, who made the sky and the sea stand up to clap and shout with delight that drowned for a while the bell of doubt that keeps on beating in everyone's heart. On the beaten path to each other that hides our tracks as we pass, on our way to the door of the one we need, who's always out when we arrive, early or late for the rendezvous we never made and never broke. We hear the sea barking as we run past the stadium, the sound of oars above and battered hearts below, the world hardly breathing as it slips again through a gap we can't see to where the king and the poet are standing, ill at ease among the wooden angels outside the padlocked church. They can't believe that no one has followed them, no one at all. Thank you.